Hachette Audio presents Hope to Die, written by James Patterson, read by Michael Boatman and Scott Sowers. For the courageous men and women of the Palm Beach Police Department. Part 1.
Chapter 1. When Marcus Sunday arrived at Whodunit Books in Philadelphia around 7 that evening, the manager told him not to expect much of a crowd. It was the Tuesday after Easter. Lots of people were still away on vacation, and it was raining. But Sunday and the manager were pleasantly surprised when 25 people showed up to hear him read and discuss his controversial true crime book, The Perfect Criminal. The manager introduced him, saying, "Marcus Sunday, who has a doctorate in philosophy from Harvard, has hit bestseller lists around the country with this book, a fascinating look at two unsolved mass murder cases explained by a truly original mind focused on the depths of the criminal soul." The crowd clapped, and Sunday, a tall, sturdy man who looked to be in his late 30s, stepped to the lectern wearing a black leather jacket, jeans, and a crisp white shirt. "I appreciate you coming out on a rainy night," he said, "and it's a pleasure to be here at Whodunit Books." Then he talked about the killings. 7 years earlier, two nights before Christmas, the five members of the Daly family of suburban Omaha had been slain in their home. Except for the wife, they were all found in their beds. Their throats had been cut with a scalpel or razor. The wife had died similarly, but in the bathroom and naked. Either the doors had been unlocked or the killer had had a key. There had been a snowstorm during the night, and any tracks were buried. 14 months later, in the aftermath of a violent thunderstorm, the Monahan family of suburban Fort Worth was discovered in a similar state. A father and four children under the age of 13 were found in their beds with their throats slit. The wife, also with her throat slit, was found naked on the bathroom floor. Once more, either the doors had been unlocked or the killer had had a key. Again, owing to the storm and the killer's meticulous methods, the police found no usable evidence. "I became interested because of that lack of evidence, that void," Sunday informed his rapt audience. Sunday said that the dearth of evidence had confused him at first. He talked to all the investigators working the case, but they were equally baffled. Then his academic training took over, and he began to theorize about the philosophical worldview of such a perfect killer. "I came to the conclusion that he had to be an existentialist of some twisted sort," he said. "Someone who thinks life is meaningless, absurd, without value. Someone who does not believe in God or laws or any other kind of moral or ethical basis to life." Sunday went on in this vein for some time, reading from the book and explaining how the evidence surrounding the murder scenes supported his controversial theories and led to others. The killer's disbelief in concepts like good and evil, for example, perfected him as a criminal, made it impossible for him to feel guilty, which was what allowed him to commit such heinous acts with dispassionate precision. A man raised his hand. "You sound like you admire the killer, sir." Sunday shook his head. "I tried to describe his worldview accurately and let readers draw their own conclusions." A woman with dirty blonde hair, more handsome than beautiful, raised her hand, revealing a sleeve tattoo that depicted a panther in a colorful jungle setting. "I've read your book," she said in a southern accent. "I liked it." "That's a relief," Sunday said. Several people in the audience chuckled. The woman smiled, said, "Can you talk a little about your theory of the perfect criminal's opposite, the perfect detective?" Sunday hesitated and then said, I speculated that the only way the perfect killer would ever get caught was by a detective who was his direct antithesis. Someone who believed absolutely in God. Someone who was emblematic of the moral, ethical universe and of a meaningful life. The problem is that the perfect detective does not exist and cannot exist. Why is that? She asked. Because detectives are human, not monsters like the perfect killer, he said, seeing some confusion in the audience. Sunday smiled, said, Let me put it this way. Can you imagine a real cold-blooded, calculating mass or serial murderer suddenly turning noble, doing the right thing, saving the day? Most of the audience shook their heads. Exactly, he went on. The perfect killer is who he is. An animal like that doesn't change. Sunday paused for effect. But how hard is it to imagine a noble detective brought low by the horrors of his job? How hard is it to imagine him abandoning God? How hard is it to imagine him so beaten down by events that he finds life meaningless, valueless, and hopeless to the point that he becomes an existential monster and a perfect killer himself? That's not hard at all to imagine now, is it? Chapter 2. After signing 24 books, Sunday politely turned down the bookstore manager's offer to take him to dinner, saying that he had a previous engagement with an old friend. The rain had stopped by the time he left the store and started down the sidewalk. He crossed 20th Street and was walking past a Dunkin' Donuts when the woman with the panther tattoo fell in step beside him and said, That went well. Always helps to have the mysterious Acadia LaDuke in the audience. Acadia laughed, put her arm through his, and asked, Shall we get something to eat before we drive back to D.C.? I want to see it leave first, he replied. It's fine, she said in a reassuring tone. I watched you seal it myself. We're good for 60, no, make that about 58 hours now. Almost 70 hours if we had to push it. I know, he said. Just call me obsessive. All right, Acadia sighed. And then we're doing Thai food. I promise, Sunday said. They went to a late-model Dodge Durango parked 2 blocks away, and Sunday drove through the city until they were abreast of the empty Eagles Stadium on Darien Street. He turned left into the vast lot at Monty Wholesale Foods opposite the stadium and parked at the far end, up against the iron fence, where they could look beneath the Delaware Expressway and across into the South Philadelphia Rail Yard. Sunday picked up a pair of binoculars and found what he was looking for about 100 yards in. A line of freight cars, and one in particular, a 45-foot rust-red container, the top of which was fitted front to back with solar panels. A reefer, a refrigeration and heating unit, stuck out of the front of the container. He lowered the binoculars, checked his watch, and said, It should be rolling out of here in another 15 minutes. Bored, Acadia slouched in her seat, said, So when is Mulch going to contact Cross? Dr. Alex will get a message loud and clear on Friday morning, he said. It will be a week. He'll be ready. We have to be in St. Louis by 5 p.m. on Friday at the absolute latest, she said. Sunday felt irritated. Acadia was the smartest, most unpredictable woman he'd ever known. But she had an annoying habit of constantly reminding him about things of which he was well aware. Before he could tell her just that, he caught a flash of movement in the rail yard. He raised the binoculars again and saw a young black guy dressed in dark clothing slinking along the freight cars. He was wearing gloves and carrying a small knapsack and a crowbar. He stopped and looked up at the solar panels. Shit, Sunday said, watching the man. What? Looks like shit. What? Acadia said again. Some asshole's trying to break into our car, he said. No way, she said, sitting forward to peer into the shadows of the rail yard. How would he? He wouldn't, Sunday said. It's random. Or he saw the solar panels. What are we gonna do? Only thing we can do, he replied. 60 seconds later, Sunday and Acadia were over the fence. They split up beneath the overpass and hurried in opposite directions, both keeping low behind an earthen berm that ran next to the nearest set of tracks. Sunday carried a tire iron and was 70 yards past the rust-red container car before he stopped. The rail yard was lit, not as well as it was to the north, but he'd be visible until he reached the shadows along the freight train. He had no choice. Sunday clambered over the berm and angled out into the yard, dancing across the tracks, aware of Acadia doing the same to the north, trying not to make noise until he reached the shadows where he'd seen the black guy slinking. The container with the solar panels was 6 cars ahead. He stood there until he felt his phone buzz, alerting him to a text. Sunday started forward quickly, keeping his steps light until he was alongside the rust-red car. Hearing metal scraping metal, the sound of the crowbar working that lock, he slowed to a creep and then stopped at the corner. He waited until he felt his cell phone buzz again, and he gripped the tire iron like a hammer. Just what do you think you're doing there, mister? Acadia said. She was on the opposite side of the train. Fuck, bitch, was all the thief got to say before Sunday sprang around and spotted him up on the turnbuckle, facing Acadia and menacing her with the crowbar. Sunday's tire iron smashed into the man's knee. He grunted in pain, fell off on Acadia's side. Sunday vaulted up and over the buckle and was on the man before he could do a thing to defend himself. He aimed for the guy's head this time and connected with a thud that put the thief out cold. The third blow was more considered and caved in his skull. Breathing hard, Sunday looked at Acadia, whose eyes blazed and whose nostrils flared with the sexual excitement she always displayed after a killing. Marcus, she said, I'm suddenly... Later, he said firmly and pointed to the adjacent line of freight cars 10 feet away. Help me get him underneath that train. If we're lucky, he won't be found till morning, maybe later. They grabbed the dead guy under the armpits, dragged him and pushed him over and in between the rails, and put him face down beneath the line of rail cars. A sudden squealing noise startled them both. The freight train, including the container car with the solar panels, was moving out, heading west.
Chapter 3.
Carter Billings was amazing, Ali yelled in the twilight. His first at bat.
My 7-year-old ran up the stairs ahead of us onto the front porch of our house and adopted a funny, exaggerated batting pose while holding the little souvenir bat I had bought him earlier in the day. He waved the bat and swung wildly. He made a cracking noise and did a decent imitation of Billings's hilarious and passionate run around the bases after the rookie got a pinch hit, walk-off, grand slam home run in his very first trip to the plate, winning the opening game for the Nationals. I had gotten tickets to the game through an old friend, and we'd all seen that miraculous moment along with Ali, my wife, Bree, my older son, Damon, my daughter, Janie, and my 90-something grandmother, Nana Mama. As Ali wound down his victory run, we all clapped and crowded through the front door of our home on 5th in Southeast Washington, D.C. It had been construction time at the Cross household the past few weeks. We were remodeling the kitchen and adding a great room and a new master bedroom suite upstairs. When we left for the game, the project was exactly as the construction crew had left it on Good Friday. Exterior walls framed and up,
windows in and the roof on, an empty, dusty shell separated from the main house by plastic sheeting. But when Nanamama left the front hallway and looked deeper into our house, she stopped in her tracks and screamed, "Alex!" I rushed forward, expecting some domestic catastrophe, but my grandmother was beaming with joy. She said, "How did you ever manage it?" I looked over her shoulder and saw that the addition and the kitchen remodel were done, as in completely done. The cabinets were up, the Italian tile floor was in, so was the fire engine red six-burner industrial stove and the matching fridge and the dishwasher. I could see, beyond the kitchen, that the great room had been filled with new furniture. It looked like some gauzy picture in the Pottery Barn catalog. "How is this possible, Alex?" Bree asked. I was as shocked as the rest of my family. It was as if a genie in a lamp had given us 100 wishes, and they'd all come true. The kids ran through the kitchen and into the great room to test out the couches and the overstuffed chairs, while Nanamama and Bree admired the black granite countertops, stainless steel sinks, and pewter light fixtures. My attention, however, was drawn to a piece of legal-size paper that magnets held horizontally to the refrigerator door. At first, I figured it was a letter from our contractors saying they hoped we were pleased with the finished product. But then I saw that the paper showed copies of 5 photographs laid side by side. The images were difficult to make out until I stepped right up and took them all in with one slow, horrifying scan. In each picture, there was a member of my family lying on a cement floor, head haloed with blood, blank face and eyes twisted dully toward the camera. Above each left ear and slightly back, there was a wound, an ugly one, the kind that only a close-range shot creates. Somewhere in the distance, a siren began to wail. "No!" I screamed. But when I spun around to assure myself the pictures weren't real, my children, my wife, and my grandmother were gone, vanished into thin air. All that was left of them were those sickening photographs on the refrigerator. I am alone, I thought. Alone. Pain knifed through my head. Terrified that I was going to have a stroke or a heart attack, I sank to my knees, bowed my head, and raised my hands toward heaven. "Why, Mulch?" I screamed. "Why?" Chapter 4. I jerked awake in the pre-dawn light, felt the dull pounding in my head again. At first, I had no idea where I was, but gradually, I came to recognize my bedroom in shadows. I was in bed, still dressed for work and soaked through with sweat. Instinctively, I reached over to feel for my wife's sleeping form. Bree wasn't there. And in one gut-wrenching instant, I knew that I had woken once more into a reality worse than any nightmare. My wife was gone. They were all gone. And a madman named Thierry Mulch had them. Determined not to succumb to his insanity, I rolled over in bed and pressed my face into my wife's pillow, trying to find Bree's smell. I needed it to keep me strong, to renew my faith and hope. I caught a trace of her, but desperately wanted more. I got up, went to her closet, and, strange as it sounds, buried my face in her clothes. For several minutes, Bree's perfect scent intoxicated my brain so thoroughly that my headache was gone, and she was right there with me. This beautiful, smart, laughing woman who danced just beyond the outstretched fingers of my memory. But the sensation of having her there with me ebbed away all too fast, and the smells in her closet changed, some threatening to go stale and others sour. That petrified me. Was it the same in the other bedrooms? Were their smells fading too? Sickened and fearful at what I might find, I had to force myself to open Ali's door. Holding my breath, I went quickly inside and shut the door behind me. I didn't turn on the light, wanting to deaden one sense to heighten another. When at last I inhaled, Alex Jr.'s little boy smell was everywhere, and I could suddenly hear his voice and feel how good it was to hold my son, remember how he loved to nestle in my arms when he was tired. I went to Janny's room next. The air there left me puzzled and then upset. I guess I had gone in longing for the smells of years gone past. But Janny was finishing up her freshman year in high school and was already a track star. For a long while, I stood there in her pitch-dark bedroom, overwhelmed by the understanding that my little girl had become a woman and then vanished along with everyone else in my family. I stood outside Nana Mama's room, and my hands shook when I reached for the doorknob and twisted it. Stepping in, closing the door behind me, I breathed in her lilac air. Surrounded by dozens of vivid memories, I felt claustrophobic and had to get out of there fast. I went out and shut her door behind me, sure that I'd find better air up in my attic office where I could think more clearly. But as I started to climb the stairs, it dawned on me that one devastating odor was already gone. Damon, my 17-year-old, my firstborn, had been away at prep school in Massachusetts the past 2 months. The idea that I might never smell Damon again shattered whatever resolve I still possessed. As I flashed on those photographs that haunted my dreams, wondering if they were enactments of things to come, my headache turned excruciating. Maddened, I charged up the stairs, into my office, and stuck my face right in front of a camera hidden between two books on homicide investigations. "Why, Mulch?" I yelled. "What did I ever do to deserve this? What the hell do you want from me? Tell me! What the hell do you want from me?"
But there was no response. Just that little lens staring back at me.
I grabbed the lens, tore it free of the transmitter, and crushed it under my heel. Fuck Mulch, or Elliot, or whatever he called himself. I didn't care that I'd just showed him we knew about the bugs. Fuck him. Panting, wiping the sweat off my forehead, I decided to destroy all the bugs in the house before their presence destroyed me. Then a dog started barking across the street, and someone began to pound on my front door. Chapter 5. I opened my door to find a short, fit, and attractive brunette in her mid-30s, looking like she wanted to be anywhere but on my front porch as she held out her detective's badge. "Dr. Cross," she said. "I'm Tess Alia. I'm with Metro Homicide." "You are?" I asked, because I'd never met her before. "Came on board last week from Baltimore PD Homicide, sir," Detective Alia replied, "while you were solving the massage parlor murders and the baby kidnappings." For a moment, I was puzzled. Didn't know what she was referring to. But then, like a window opening a crack, it came back to me. Even though those cases felt like they'd enveloped me a lifetime ago, not a week, I nodded, said, "No partner, Detective, Aaliyah," she said, cocking her head to study me. "Chris Daniels is my partner, but he evidently shattered his ankle this morning lifting weights." I winced, nodded, said, "Daniels is a good guy." "Seems that way so far," she agreed. She swallowed and looked at the porch boards. "How can I help you, Detective?" Aaliyah let out a short, sharp breath before looking me in the eye. "Sir, there was a body found down the street a few blocks at a construction site. Female African American. She's been badly mutilated. And I'm sorry, Dr. Cross, but your wife's badge and ID are there as well. Is your wife here?" I almost collapsed right there. But I grabbed the door jamb and choked out, "She's missing."
"Missing?"
the detective said. "Since..." "Just take me there," I said. "I need to see this for myself." It was a 2-minute ride, which I spent in a near catatonic state. Aaliyah kept asking me questions, and I kept saying, "I need to see her." There were patrol cars ahead, and yellow tape, familiar things in my life, but I got no solace from them. I have entered murder scenes too many times to count, but I have never been as frightened of what I was about to see as I was that morning, walking next to Aaliyah, past a patrolman and through a gate in a chain-link fence that blocked off the construction site.
"She's in the bottom, sir," Aaliyah said.
I walked to the edge and looked down into the hole dug for the foundation. Crushed stone and rebar filled the bottom of the excavation, ready for cement. A woman of Bree's height, build, and hairstyle lay on her right side, her back to me. Streams of dried blood caked her skin from scores of oval wounds to her entire dorsal side. She was wearing the same bra and panties Bree had been wearing on Good Friday. And that was Bree's watch. I staggered a step closer to the edge, felt bolts of lightning go off in my head, and thought for certain I was going to fall in there with her. But Detective Aaliyah grabbed hold of my elbow.
"Is it her, Dr. Cross?" she asked. "Bree Stone?"
I stared at her dumbly, then said, "I have to go down." We went to a ladder, and how I climbed down it, I'll never know. Every step broke my heart. Every handhold was my last. I stepped through the crisscrossed rebar and around the front, seeing that the earrings were definitely the same ones I'd given Bree on our anniversary. An alien moan came up out of my gut. Taking another step, I saw that her face had been beaten beyond recognition, and that the wounding pattern had continued down the front of her body, as if someone had used garden clippers to snip off ovals of her skin every 5 or 10 inches of her entire body, right out to the engagement ring I'd given her and her wedding band, right out to bloody stumps where the tips of her fingers should have been. Her mouth was open, and her teeth were missing. "Oh, dear Jesus," I whispered in shock, sinking to my knees in front of her. "What has that sick bastard mulch done to you?" Chapter 6. "Is it your wife, Dr. Cross?" Detective Aaliyah asked. I stared at the desecrated body lying there before me, saw the hair, the skin color, the height, the weight, the jewelry, and said,
I don't know. I think so, but I don't know for certain. She's unrecognizable like this. Where were you last night? She asked, scanning the body for something, anything that said definitively whether it was Bree or not. I replied, I was home, detective, watching reruns of The Walking Dead. Sir? The television show about the zombie apocalypse, I said. My boy Ali loves it. And he was there with you? I shook my head again, felt tears trickle from my eyes, and said, he's gone too. They're all gone. My entire family. Haven't they told you? John Sampson? Captain Quintus? The FBI? FBI, she said. No, I caught this on my way to work. But why don't we get out of here, let forensics do their job, and you tell me what I need to know. I knelt there for several more moments, staring at the body and seeing images of my life with Bree playing in the air, making it all surreal and soul-killing. Dr. Cross? I nodded, got wobblingly to my feet, and managed to climb back up the ladder without incident. We went to her unmarked car and got in. Let's hear it, she said in a calm, professional manner. Over the next 35 minutes, I laid out the insanity of the past few weeks for her, trying not to leave out any important details. I first learned of Thierry Mulch when he started sending me strange, taunting letters about the massage parlor murders, calling me an idiot and proposing theories about those killings that, I admit, proved invaluable in ultimately catching the man responsible. Then a man named Thierry Mulch, who claimed to be a website entrepreneur, went to my son Ali's school and gave a talk there. I did a Google search on the name. It turned out there were only 7 Thierry Mulches that I could find on the web, and one of them was an internet entrepreneur. Because I was chest deep in the investigation of the mass killings at the massage parlor, I didn't give the coincidence much thought beyond that. But it turned out Mulch had been giving me and my family a lot of thought, I told the detective. He bugged our house with audio and video. I think he used them to learn our habits and routines, because in a matter of hours last Friday, Good Friday, he managed to kidnap them all, including my son Damon, who goes to school up in the Berkshires in Massachusetts. How come I haven't heard a word of this? She asked. And how do you know Mulch took them? Give me a chance to explain. Aaliyah nodded, and I told her how Mulch used my daughter's cell phone the night of Good Friday to send me pictures of my family, tied up, duct tape across their mouths. He also sent texts threatening to kill them all if I got the police or FBI involved. Late the next afternoon, John Sampson, my best friend and partner at Metro, came to my door, concerned that I hadn't reported to work or at least called in to explain why I was out. I got John to leave and did not tell him a thing, but Mulch didn't care, I said, digging in my pocket for my phone. I began getting these pictures every hour on the hour. I handed her the phone, told her to call up photos. She did, and I saw the horror on her face as she looked at the pictures on the tiny screen, showing each and every member of my family dead of a gunshot wound to the head. Are they real? She asked. No, I said. But I didn't know that then. I told Aaliyah how I disintegrated after seeing the pictures. I walked the streets of Washington like a zombie, praying someone would blow my head off. In the end, I went into a meth house with a wad of cash and told the addicts I wanted to die, that I'd pay them to kill me. Someone obligingly tried, hitting me with a piece of metal pipe. A girl who once lived with us, a recovering addict named Ava, found me and brought me home. I told Ava about the pictures just before I passed out from the concussion I'd sustained. Ava is very bright and excellent with computers, I said. While I slept, she transferred the pictures to a laptop and blew them up enough to see they were doctored. Ava took that information to Samson and to Ned Mahoney, my former partner in the Behavioral Sciences Division of the FBI. Ava convinced them that my family was not dead. Samson and Mahoney found a way to sneak into my house without being detected by Mulch's bugs. It turned out there'd been a rape in Alexandria, Virginia, committed by a man who called himself Thierry Mulch. DNA evidence gathered at that crime scene had been matched to the DNA of a brilliant but erratic computer engineering student at George Mason University, who disappeared about 2 weeks before. His name was Preston Elliott, and given the sophistication of the electronics Mulch put in my house, we believed and still believe that Elliott and Mulch are one and the same. We left the bugs in my house and decided that I would continue acting as if I thought everyone in my family was dead in order to convince Mulch slash Elliott that I was completely devastated, a victim, and no threat. We also decided to keep everything about the hunt for my family quiet, I said. Days went by, and now a week, and we hadn't heard a thing from him until this. Expressionless, Detective Aaliyah mulled over everything I had told her for several minutes. Finally, she said, "You think Mulch, Elliot, is responsible for the Jane Doe's death?" "He is responsible," I said. "There's no question." Aaliyah thought for several beats and then asked, "What does he gain from doing all this to you and your family?" "I've stopped asking," I replied. "But whatever sicko obsessive reason he's got for targeting me on my end, it feels like torture. Like he's trying to drive me to the brink again and again, hoping that sooner or later I'll jump off." She cocked her head and asked, "Will you? If that is Bree in that hole, honestly, I don't know."
Chapter 7. On the whole, Marcus Sunday was pleased with the way things were proceeding. There'd been a few deviations from the original plan, but he still felt right on target. Sunday was riding in the front passenger seat of the Durango, raptly focused on the screen of a laptop computer and the video feed transmitting from a tiny camera, hidden weeks before, high up in a tree that overlooked the construction site. He'd seen it all. How Cross fell to his knees in front of the body and stayed there for a very long time, looking crushed. "The end is near," he said to Acadia, who was in the back seat. "Did you see the way he was begging right into the camera in his office before the cop banged on his door? Begging's a classic indicator, isn't it, Mitch?" The driver, a hulk of a man in jeans, hiking boots, and a Boston Red Sox jersey, nodded, said, "It is, Marcus." Acadia wasn't buying it. "How'd you know?" Mitch Cochran had no neck to speak of. His massive head seemed to her like an extension of his shoulders as he glanced back and said, "Before I said fuck it all, I was in Iraq. U.S. fucking Army. Guarded Abu Ghraib prison. I saw interrogations. It's like Marcus said, they beg before they crack. All of them." Acadia remained unhappy. "But how long can we wait for that to happen?" "It won't be long now," Sunday assured her. "Mulch has killed Cross's wife, and the rest of his family remains under mortal threat." "How long?" she demanded. Sunday grew irritated, growled, You can't put a firm timetable on a project of this magnitude, Acadia. Haven't I told you again and again that the construction of a monster begins with the destruction of a man? You've said a lot of things, Acadia shot back. Like that Cross would crumble the night we sent those pictures? Cross was in pieces, he snapped. He still is, and it's growing worse. Didn't you just see that with your own eyes? He's disintegrating. Acadia was silent for several long moments before saying, "Well, I think about it, sending those photographs was a mistake." "A mistake," Sunday replied, clearly annoyed. Acadia said, "You went for the short-term shock value of having Cross see his entire family murdered with gunshot wounds to the head. But you were also giving away leverage. You did the same thing by dumping her there. A dead person can't be helped, Marcus. A dead person can't be saved. There's less motivation now for him to become the perfect killer you want him to be." "Your understanding of the animal condition is shallow at times, Acadia," Sunday sniffed. "This is all timing." "What's that supposed to mean?" she said, crossing her arms. "Ever watch a dog trainer at work?" he asked. "I mean a real trainer, someone who teaches hunting or attack dogs." "My shithead of a daddy ran coon hounds." "Then you know what the predator-prey response is?" "I can guess," she said. "Critter runs in the woods, a dog chases it, tries to kill it. It's in its nature." "There you go," Sunday said, snapping his fingers at her. "And the way trainers build that predator-prey response is by taking something away from the dog, something that the dog values highly, like a bone or a toy. They let Bowser go for days thinking his favorite bone or toy is gone for good. Then they show it to him attached to a rope. When that dog goes to chase his toy, the trainer jerks it just out of reach. All the time, just out of reach. Isn't that right, Mitch?" Cochran downshifted and slowed, saying, "The dog goes fucking crazy, doing anything in his power to have that toy again. That's when the trainer steps in and takes total control of the situation, uses the toy as a reward for a job well done." He glanced at Acadia. "And how do I know that? We had fucking dogs at Abu Ghraib. Lots of them." Cochran took a right turn onto a muddy road a few miles south of Frostburg in rural northwestern Maryland. They passed a ramshackle farm, and Sunday heard the echoes of pigs squealing in his mind. The road wound up into an oak forest clad in new lime green leaves. A mile into the woods, Sunday started looking at the trees closely, and then he said, "That's it. Those birches on the right. Park over there." Chapter 8. Cochran pulled the Durango almost to the drainage ditch next to three birches that grew close together, almost as if they were shoots of the same tree. "We've got 10 minutes still," Sunday said, and he turned his attention to the laptop again. But Cross was nowhere to be seen around the construction site. "You can't go in early?" Acadia asked, sounding irked. "I told you 72 hours is the limit of how far we can push things. That window's closing fast." Sunday checked his watch. "We're at 67 hours. We'll make it." "I gotta go number two," Cochran said. "What are you, in kindergarten?" Acadia snapped. "Maybe that's my problem. I'm too fucking childlike," Cochran laughed, got out of the car and walked off. Sunday looked off through the windshield in silence and then said, "That farm we passed brought back memories. Mulch grew up in a hellhole like that." "The fabled origins?" Acadia asked. "Whence mulch sprang, and where mulch died. Ever been back?" "Not even close," Sunday said, checking his watch. "I think I'm good to go now." "Sure you don't want one of us along?" Acadia asked. Sunday shook his head and said, It took me a long time to find this guy and gain his trust. I don't want to spook him in any way, especially not now, when he's proven so resourceful. Don't forget the honey, Acadia said, and she handed Sunday a small gym bag with a Nike swoosh on it. I'm not back in 15, you and Cochran come looking, but slow, right? Armed? Definitely. Sunday got out, smelling the rot of spring everywhere around him. It had started to sprinkle. He decided he liked the light rain. Hitting the new leaves on the trees, it would soften all other sound and give him a chance to check out the scene before he fully committed. Sunday slid down the bank, then found and followed an overgrown logging trail, mindful to keep the bag raised so the brambles and thorns would not tear it. Soon he smelled wood smoke and slowed to a creep. He approached a ledge that overlooked a clearing and beyond it, a swollen creek. To his right and below, hard by the creek bank, there was a plywood and tar paper shack. Smoke curled from a stovepipe that jutted from the roof. An old blue Chevy pickup with a capper sat between the shack and a barn of sorts. Sunday noticed the sheet across the window that faced in his direction was fluttering, and he knew he'd been spotted. So he held up the bag and climbed over the ledge and down into the yard. A door creaked open. A big male Rottweiler came bounding out toward him. Sunday stopped and stayed perfectly still, his eyes watching the dark space beyond the door as the dog growled low and circled him, taking his wind. When the dog barked, the door opened wider, and Sunday crossed to the shack. He climbed the stoop, passing a chainsaw and a gas can, and went inside. That necessary every time, Sunday asked the muscular bald guy crossing the dim space to a crude kitchen. His name was Claude Harrow. Every time, Harrow replied. Puts a man's mind at ease, especially now that you and I done crossed a dark line together. The dog came in behind him. Sunday shut the door and stood there until his eyes adjusted, and he could make out the formica table, lawn chairs, busted couch, and wood stove in the corner. The walls were bare except for a large Confederate flag and a framed 8x10 photograph of Adolf Hitler in full salute. The dog went to the stove and lay down by the stove, head up, watching Sunday. Looked like it all went according to plan, Sunday said, smelling bleach and seeing a wash tub close to him on the floor. Two butcher knives and a pair of tin snips were soaking in 3 inches of chlorine in water. Well, what did you expect, amateur hour? Harrow replied, and he turned to him, revealing a thin, nasty scar on his right cheek and a tattoo of a flaming sword on the side of his neck. Sunday noticed a mirror on the table and saw the traces of white lines on it. He frowned. Thought we agreed no tweaking during the game. We said during, not after, Harrow replied. Don't worry. It's just a pick-me-up. I've been up all night and had the jitters by the time I got back here. Sunday debated whether to press the point, decided not to, and held out the gym bag, saying, balance on the first is there, plus a down payment on number two. Harrow motioned for him to put it on the table, asked, how soon? Tonight. The older boy. Sunday could tell Harrow didn't like that. That kind of short notice and tight turnaround is going to cost you, Harrow said. How much? To pull it off clean like that? 100K more on the back end. Sunday didn't like renegotiations. Quite a jump in pay. Hell of a risk I'm taking. Cops involved, right? I think you'd do it even if I weren't paying you a small fortune, Sunday said, setting the bag down. I might, Harrow agreed, smiling for the first time. Cops aside, I do enjoy and appreciate the cleaning work. You'll let me know when it's done?
Man's gotta get paid, don't he? You want coffee?
Sorry, I have to catch a plane. Be in St. Louis by 5, no ifs, ands, or buts, Sunday said, heading toward the door. And if you aren't, bad stuff happens.
Chapter 9. John Sampson arrived as I watched the body bag being brought up out of the hole. Built like a power forward in the NBA, he looked as weak as a kitten when he came to me with tears welling in his eyes. John and I have been brothers in all but genetics since we were 10 years old. When the big man threw his arms around me, it was everything I could do not to dissolve right then and there.
Jesus Christ, Alex, Sampson said hoarsely. I came as soon as I heard. Is it true?
Is it? I think so, but I don't know for certain, and I won't until tomorrow at least, and that may be the worst part, I said in a dull voice as they put the body bag on a stretcher and wheeled it over to the medical examiner's van. I kept trying to think of the body in the bag as being someone other than Bree, but Mulch, he...
You want me to take you home? Sampson asked.
No, I said. Home's not a good place for me. Mulch watches me there, enjoys my suffering, and I won't contribute to his enjoyment anymore. I just need to go for a walk and get my head straight.
Want company?
He asked. I'll see you later at work.
Sugar, you can't work when something like...
John, I have to work when something like this is going on, I said firmly. It's the only way I'll stay sane. Sampson looked like he wanted to tell me something, but Detective Aaliyah came over, said, Dr. Cross, I have... John, this is Tess Aaliyah, I said. She's new, from Baltimore, and she caught this case and needs to be brought up to speed on what the Secret Task Force has found out about Mulch.
Secret Task Force? Aaliyah said.
Exactly, I said, and walked off, trying to convince myself that that wasn't my wife's body in the back of that coroner's wagon. But grief and loss have a way of crippling the best intentions, even in the strongest of minds. Within a block of leaving the crime scene, I was lost in memories of my first days with Bree. How she'd rescued me from a long loneliness with an unshakable love, the kind I thought I'd lost forever. Then the likelihood that she was gone hit me like a freight train, and I began to choke and sob right there on the sidewalk. Every woman I'd ever loved had ended up dead or so traumatized by the violence woven through my life that she couldn't bear the sight of me. My first wife, Maria, died in a drive-by shooting when Damon was a toddler and Janie was just a baby. A madman took Ali's mother hostage, and even though we managed to rescue her, it permanently fractured our relationship. And now Bree, the absolute love of my life, might have been swallowed up by the darkness that had shadowed me without pause almost since the moment I became a police officer. What about my kids? What about my grandmother? Were they completely doomed to follow my loves into the shadows and the darkness? And what about me? Was I already there? I asked myself as I walked on, wiping tears from my eyes. Had I ever left? Could I ever leave? On autopilot, I took a route I'd taken 1,000 times with my children. Every morning, or as often as was possible, I'd walked them to their school, Sojourner Truth. I did it for years, and as I retraced those steps, I was soon drowning in memories of Damon, Janie, and Ali as each headed to the first day of first grade. Damon had gone willingly, eagerly. It was all he and his friends had talked about. But Janie and Alex Jr. had been nervous.
What if I get a bad teacher? Janie asked.
Ali had asked the same thing, and in my mind, suddenly, Jani and Ali were right there, together, both six and both looking at me for a response. I squatted down to them and pulled them in close to me, rejoicing in their smell and their innocence. "There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you," I said, "and I love you. That's all you need to know."
"Love you more," Jani said.
"Love you more,"
Ali said. "Love you more and more," I whispered. "Love you." A woman said, "Dr. Cross?" Chapter 10. Startled out of that perfect vision of my life before Thierry Mulch, I was shocked to find myself at the fence around the Sojourner Truth playground. It was deserted. I thought I heard the school bell sound for recess. But where was the laughter of my children?
"Dr. Cross?"
Blinking, I turned my head to see a tall, pretty African-American woman in a blue pantsuit standing beside me on the sidewalk, her face painted in concern.
"Yes,"
I said, almost recognizing her, feeling irritated and not quite knowing why. She looked at me closely, said,
"You don't look well."
"I'm just... where are the kids?" The bell rang. "It's recess time."
"It's Easter vacation," she said.
I looked at her like she was a stranger in a dream.
"Dr. Cross," she said, "do you know who I am?"
I did, suddenly, and felt myself grow irrationally angry. "You're Dawson, the principal. You're the one who let Mulch in. Where have you been? We've been trying to find you." My expression and tone must have frightened her because she took a step back.
"I'm sorry. I was on vacation. I don't..."
"Thierry Mulch," I shouted. "You let that sick fuck into Ali's school. You let him near all those children."
"What?"
she said, her hand going to her lips.
"What's he done?"
"He kidnapped my family," I said. "He may have killed my wife. He may be getting ready to kill Ali." The principal was horrified.
"My God, no!"
I saw how strongly she reacted, and it shook me out of the fugue state where I'd been wandering. "We left messages for you all week here at the school," I said. "The FBI, the police."
"I'm so sorry,"
Dawson said, her voice quivering.
"I was in Jamaica, visiting my cousins, and I only just got back. I was going to my office to get ready for next week when I saw you standing here. How can I help? Anything."
"Tell me about Thierry Mulch. Everything you know." Dawson said that Mulch had contacted her out of the blue, first by email and then by phone. He said he was a web entrepreneur who had had several successful ventures, but was looking for a different demographic and a bigger audience. His idea was to create a social media platform for the 6 to 12-year-old crowd that could be accessed only by verified members of that crowd. To keep out the perverts?
"That's right."
"Not a bad business concept."
"That's what I thought. So when he asked to come speak to the kids, I saw it as an opportunity. And he checked out completely. I mean, his company has a legitimate website. Here, come into my office. I'll show you."
We went to the front doors of the school. She opened them and we went inside, turning on lights. The odors in the hallway were so familiar and so intertwined with memories of my children that I stopped breathing through my nose. In her office, Dawson got on her desktop computer, typed, and then frowned before typing again. With a sinking expression, she said,
"Either I've got it wrong or the website's gone offline."
The principal started rummaging in her desk, said, "But I've got his business card here, some... Here it is."
"Don't touch it," I yelled, coming around the desk quickly as she shrank back. "I'm sorry. It's just that we'll want to fingerprint it." In a thin voice, she said,
"He wore thin white gloves."
"Of course he did," I said, wanting to punch a wall. "But just the same, do you have a plastic sandwich bag?"
"Will an envelope do?"
"Yes." She got me an envelope, and I used a pair of tweezers to pluck the business card from the drawer and place it on her desk.
"I've got a photocopy of his driver's license, too," she said.
"We've already got one of those, but thanks," I replied, studying the card and then taking a picture of it with my smartphone. "Thierry Mulch, President, TMI Entertainment, Beverly Hills." It gave a phone number in the 213 area code and an address on Wilshire Boulevard. It also had a web address, www.tmie1.info, and an email address, tmulch@tmie1.info. I was about to drop the card into the envelope and take it with me downtown for processing when something about the URL and the email pinged deep in my recent memory. Try www.tmie.com on your computer. Principal Dawson frowned, typed the URL in, and struck return. The screen blinked, and up came the home page of TMI Enterprises, a multimedia and social networking company.
"This is it," she said. "This is his website.
Click on Corporate Officers." She did, and the screen jumped to another page that featured pictures and short bios of the people running the company. At the top of the heap was someone I'd seen when I'd visited the website 2 weeks before, a blonde surfer-type guy in his late 20s wearing thick black glasses and a black hoodie.
"That's not the picture of Mulch I saw on the other version of the website,"
Dawson said.
"I saw the guy who came here, red hair, red beard, everything."
"Will the real Thierry Mulch please stand up?" I said, and I felt the throbbing in my head start up all over again. Chapter 11. My head was still pounding when I reached the sealed-off construction area on the third floor of Metro headquarters. Men in hard hats and respirator masks were using sledgehammers to bust down drywall. The air was full of gypsum dust as I went to the plastic sheeting that sealed off the destructing from the already destructed. I started to cough, and that only made the pain in my head worse. A part of me wanted to shut down then, to curl up in a fetal position right there in the dust and let it settle on me as I mourned my wife. But a greater part of me needed to keep pushing on. If I was to have any hope of saving the rest of my family, I had to keep moving, keep asking questions, keep fighting as long and as hard as possible. I tore open the flap and stepped inside a large space already stripped down to the cement floors. In the middle, under a bank of fluorescent shop lights, stood 8 desks. At them, or around them, good men and women were working. Ned Mahoney, my old partner at the FBI, was talking with Sampson. Mahoney spotted me and jumped up.
"Jesus, Alex, I just heard, and I'm so goddamn... I don't know what to say, except I promise you, we're moving heaven and earth to find this bastard."
I swallowed hard, patted him on the shoulder. Mahoney and I had worked together in behavioral sciences at Quantico. We'd toiled on too many cases involving the criminally insane to bullshit each other with psychological nuances and false premises. "Ned," I managed.